Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of Philadelphia, in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. This is episode 54. We call it Don't Feed the Bears. In this radio expedition, we ask the question, how should I prepare in terms of risk management and safety for an expedition into the Arctic? Be it a research trip or not, what natural and biological hazards exist that should be considered in planning and training for time in the high north? Our first guest, Ann Kristen Austad, is project manager for the Arctic Safety Center located in Longyearbyen, Svalbard, in the north of Norway. Our second guest is Patrick Schoedi, who some of you might remember shared with us his pinhole photography techniques way back in Pinhole Geographies, our show's second episode. He returns to the show to talk to us about his experiences as a polar bear guard on Svalbard. Stay tuned. So the Arctic Safety Center is based in Longyearbyen, Svalbard, and I want to read from their project summary to get us started here. The natural environment in the high north is undergoing rapid change, while at the same time the interest in presence and economic development in the region has never been greater. As a consequence, the need for increased competence and sharing of experience in how to operate in a safe and environmental manner in the high Arctic is acute and extremely relevant. Both the location of UNIS, which is a university in Svalbard, and years of experience collection related to Arctic safety makes Svalbard an excellent location for an Arctic safety competence center. There's already a demand from several national and international partners for an Arctic safety center. The purpose is to contribute to as safe and sustainable human activity in the high Arctic as possible. And the deliverables are as follows: a master program in Arctic safety. It sounds so fascinating to me, actually. Practical safety courses for industry, academia, and residents of Longyearbyen. And new knowledge, theory, and models. And like I mentioned, on our show tonight, we have Ann Kristen Austad coming to us from Longyearbyen, the largest town on the archipelago of Svalbard. And we'll jump right in. One of our interests on the show is talking about how we frame different regions. I'm hearing you say Arctic in some of the literature on your website. You also say high north. What are those? Yeah. What's the difference for you in those terms? How do you use those differently?
I've been thinking about that because I used to work in an oil company. And there we talked about stretched Arctic, workable Arctic. Huh. But for me, I would say Arctic there are some factors that have to be in place: the remoteness, lack of infrastructure, and the climate. If you have those factors and are above the Arctic Circle, then I would say it's Arctic.
Right.
And that then region has some specific challenges.
Yeah, and then high north suggests the people live there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you have settlements there.
Yeah, so high north settlements, right, all right. So yeah. Arctic but Safety
there are
Center.
There are different ways of interpreting actually what you put in Arctic. I've looked and there are millions of of definitions of it. But right. I think Arctic actually means bear.
Oh, yeah.
In Greek, yeah.
Okay, and speaking of bears, polar bears have to be one of the major topics as well, yeah?
Yeah. They are, because we have biohazard, and that covers polar bear, it covers rabies, it covers Arctic fox, it covers bacteria that can come from mice. So it covers that type of risks as well. But of course, it's very easy to pick on the polar bears and say that that is the biggest risk on Svalbard.
Yeah.
I would think that avalanche and also staying out in the terrain, it's a much bigger risk. But of course, the consequence, if you should have an encounter with a polar bear, could be dramatic. But the likelihood of it is very little. So, but of course you need to be prepared and you need to know how to deal with that risk. But it is very rare that there is an encounter between a polar bear and a human. Very rare.
Yeah, and perhaps maybe more some of these other bacteria might affect people, or just exposure to the elements, right? It's probably more
apt to... especially the avalanche is really... And also you have that... You have the change in the climate now, where you have much more precipitation, which creates a challenge because there is this permafrost where the water doesn't go into the ground and stays on top. So it freezes from below and melts from above, and that creates a lot of water floating. So these type of risks is more challenging, I would say. But of course, then it again is how you see it.
Right, but so
this
you're
is just
you're,
my perception.
Yeah, I mean, you're noticing climate change happening right there. There's a great example with the permafrost. So you expect an increase in flooding probably in the years to come.
We have had actually, at least since I've been here for 4 years.
Yeah,
where actually the road flooded away. It's in November.
Wow.
It's very ironic because it's not normal.
Yeah.
So, but if it's, I cannot say if this is climate change due to international or if it's just local, because locally you see it very quickly here.
Yeah.
But if this will generate through the whole Norway or through the whole of the world, I wouldn't know. But at least locally you see it very quickly.
Yeah.
And you see that the temperature is increasing. So it's warmer than it was.
Yeah.
Maybe you have more precipitation that you used to have before.
Right. More.
Which is not normal here. It's supposed to be an Arctic desert.
Right.
So,
So I'm hearing like the difference between looking at Svalbard locally and understanding what's happened there locally in reference or in relation to, let's say, the rest of the world. But let's take that similar thinking with the best practices that the safety center is implementing and is training people, new arrivals to the Arctic, probably a lot of times, or people that have been there before but are going to be going deeper into regions where there's no people and they need to be able to assess risks better. Where's that knowledge about how to mediate those risks? Where is that coming from? Is that local knowledge, or is it best practices that have come from previous expeditions, previous scientific, the presence of science and research in the Arctic region? Where are you getting those best practices from?
Yeah, of course we have had students going into the field for decades. I think mid 1990s, UNIS started up. At least the research center was the buildings and the infrastructure was in place in the middle of 1995. But I think it started before that as well. So we have a lot of experience in that area.
Yeah.
With both students and researchers. But we have only had smaller groups going into the field, and we are mostly terrestrial, so we have not that much experience for the maritime segment. But we are increasing that competence as well. We're joining into different research projects to gather that competence, to get more experience and get a hold of the good and the bad incidences that has happened so that we can learn. But we also have several partners, and they have experiences different than from us. For instance, like we have the governor.
Mm-hmm.
They get the governor of Svalbard. They are the ones on the scene. They are the commander. They would decide what to do, what to not do. So they have incidences, and they share what they can share with us. And they are also partner in the center, so that is really good for us.
Yeah.
We have Store Norske, which is the local mining company,
mm-hmm.
and they have been here since, I think, beginning of 19th century or mid-19th century.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of incidences where they have had people have been killed in the mine. They have been transporting people on the mountain where there have been incidences. So those type of experiences we have collected.
Yeah.
And the students will get access to those type of data when they do their research. And also we have the local council. They have some data that is useful for the students to utilize when they do their research.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Norwegian Polar Institute. And they have a lot of experience by having larger expeditions going to both the North Pole. They also go to Antarctica. They go to different places. So they are a very important partner for us. And yeah. They also have competence within the areas where we are not that strong. For instance, with the polar bear.
Yeah.
They have a lot of competence on that, and also with rabies and the there is this parasite that I don't remember the name of. They have a lot of competence on those specific type of diseases.
Yeah.
And of course, the tourist organizations, they are also a partner, and they have a lot of competence. They have had the people in the field. They have been to places. They have experienced incidences where it could have ended really badly. It ended well. So these type of partners are very useful for us to collect data.
Yeah.
And also let the students have access to as much as they can. Of course, like from the governor's side, there is some data that cannot be shared due to there's a confidentiality and those kind of things.
Sure.
But what they can share, they are sharing. And I think that is important for us to learn and how to move forward and have to increase the risk focus is to have that competence.
Yeah.
So I think we have, I wouldn't say it's only for us, from us that the competence comes from, but Mia or maybe writing it in the pen.
Yeah.
And also what it could be said also, because you were mentioning that we have a lot of people, like the living time on Svalbard is like 2 to 3 years, mm-hmm. 3 to 5 years. And that means that there's no local knowledge or also that the knowledge that you knew due to changes, it doesn't necessarily always are true anymore. Like the where you could go at that time of year,
yeah.
Maybe it doesn't apply anymore because there's a change. So to have these yearly seminars that we have it once a year. It's for free. The 3 hours, three nights a week, and then they come and then they sit and listen to lectures. And then there's a collaboration between the governor. We have the Norwegian Polar Institute, and we have us. And we give them awareness of how to behave in the terrain,
yeah.
How to think about the polar bears, and we also give them practical training on the shooting range. Because there is many people who come up here, they have access to a gun, or they can rent or buy a gun if they have if they're within the law or something,
yeah.
You can say.
Uh-huh.
But do they? It's not sure that they necessarily know how to use it. So to get to train that and get to become familiar with the weapon, the rifle, so that if you are in a situation where you need it, that you actually know what to do.
Yeah.
So they have become quite popular, those open seminars that we have. So I think to educate the population also.
Yeah.
That helps the governor, helps the rescue organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So who attends the seminars? Who I mentioned before, and I assume there's people from academia wanting to do research on a range of things, not just, I'm sure climate change is one of those things, but
yeah.
On a different range of topics and themes. You have people from industry because of the mining operations
yeah.
that exist. The residents, I guess, of Svalbard. Anybody else? I mean, who else comes to
those,
learn?
Those open seminars that we have, those two are for free. The people in town comes.
Yeah.
People
okay.
just moved up here. If there, especially when it comes to avalanche, there tends to be quite many people who come.
Hmm.
So then it's the people who live here. And
yeah.
But for when they buy, if they're going to do research,
yeah.
then they turn to us and we develop a course based on what they need. If they're going to be out on the sea, then they would need some sea training, like, for instance, to use the survival suit, the life raft, and those kind of things.
Yeah.
But if they're going to drive a snowmobile, they get the snowmobile course. Everyone gets a half a day at the shooting range to know about to handle a gun.
Right.
So it's depending on what they need, actually, and what they're going to do.
So you do customize the training package for particular groups. Yeah.
And if it's winter, and the students who come up here, if it's winter season, then they all need to go through a six-day course where they actually have from 8 in the morning to 8 in the evening for 6 days, where they go through everything from traveling on sea ice to work on glaciers, if they need to rescue someone from a crevasse, it's handling a rifle, it's to the risk assessment forms, communication, navigation, all these things that then they have to take that. But if it's in the fall, then it's a bit less. Then it's not so expensive. Maybe it's 3 days.
Right. Or where do some of the researchers go? I mean, is it limited only to Svalbard? Or do you have people that are coming for training that then are going to go research close to the North Pole? I mean, do you have a wider geography than just Svalbard?
Yes, this is how I actually became in contact with the University Center for the first time. Was I worked for Equinor, now it's called Equinor, which is Norway's biggest oil company.
Yeah.
And we were going to do some measurements out northeast of Greenland. And we looked into our procedures and saw that this is not fit for where we're going. Our ways of dealing with risk on the Norwegian continental shelf is different than how we need to work in the Arctic, especially when it comes such a high north as we were going. So then we turned to UNES, and they customized the course for us.
All right.
Introduction, course, familiarization, we did all these things. And this is what, and now we did it for, have you heard about Lanse, when they froze in Lanse? It's a research vessel.
Yeah.
Yeah, and let it drift. There we had some enrollment in that. And also, there is a new project now that is called the Mosaic Project, which is run through the Alfred Wegener Institute. And they are going to drift, freeze in a vessel, and let it drift over the North Pole. And here we are going to provide them with customized safety course, six courses.
Oh, wow.
So we do customize, and it's not only for Svalbard, but of course, if they're here and they're going to do research here, it's very easy for us to that we have that already in place.
Yeah.
But we do customize.
Yeah. So let me throw this out, and this is hypothetical. I teach an advanced geography course, and if I was to take, and I teach, let's say, 17 and 18-year-olds, if I was to take a group of 10 of them to Svalbard and wanted to go do some research at, say, one of the old mining camps or towns, one of the old outposts that exists there. There's still some mark on the cultural landscape, so to speak, an old building. One of those kind of places that's, let's say, 3 hours by snowmobile from Longyearbyen. What would we have to do, first off? Maybe there's some legal things. We'd have to learn how to shoot a gun and set up our camp a certain way, I think. But what would you do in terms of a training for us if we were to go as a group to do so, like a week of research?
First, I would need to know what you were actually going to do, what type of research you were going to do.
Okay.
Were you handling machines? Were you using a snowmobile? Were you walking there? Were you driving by boat? Or how would you get there? I would need to know more about your project, and then I guess we would have like a familiarization. And then you would come, and we would. It would depend if it was on the winter season. You would have a more extensive course. First, you would have a snowmobile course.
We
would take you through, and you would learn how to do our introduction course when it comes to HSD forms, risk assessment forms, and those type of things. And then we would, if you're going to travel on sea ice, we would have to have a rerun of how you actually behave on sea ice.
Okay.
If you're going to cross some glaciers, that would be covered. Do you have necessary camps? We would go through our emergency kit, which always is on the sledge. that you know how to use the equipment that you have in there in case you need to establish an emergency camp. Also, how about communication? Because you lose your cell phone coverage almost immediately after you, very shortly after you go on your snowmobile, you don't have coverage. So what plans do you have? Are you going to use an inReach? Are you going to use satellite phone? Do you know how to operate those things? Also, we will go very shortly through navigation. How will you get there? Do you know how to use the GPS, map and a compass, these type of things?
Yeah.
And the clothing, especially clothing, and also be in cold climate.
Yeah.
Because the frostbite and get white spots, the wind chill is very, you can have, like yesterday was 5 minus degrees, but it felt like 15 because there was a very strong wind.
Yeah.
So these type of things you would know. So it's quite extensive, actually. But if it was in the August, it's different.
Yeah.
Of course, then you have no snow. I guess you would go by boat, but then you would do a maritime training. So it would depend on what you need. So we would set it up based on where you are going and also the season you're in.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's pretty...
But actually, we do these things. I had, just before Easter, there was a French school class.
All right.
They were 15 years old. They were going to do a small expedition. They were going to go skiing up a glacier, stay on another glacier for 2 days in a tent, and go back. It was like 3 or 4 days. So then I went through and showed them how they plotted out the route in the on the map.
Right.
And looked at if there were avalanche-prone terrains, if there were risk of polar bears, how was the weather, checked for different sites when it comes to the avalanche risk. There are different web pages you can go to look into if it's a high-risk time or if it's quite safe.
Uh-huh.
If there are crevasses on the glacier they were going, and if they had set up routines in the camp. So we went through all these things and
And did they go with local guides then as well? I mean,
Yes. So this was more for learning for them to see how we prepare.
Yeah.
They have someone, but they were going to take part in being polar bear watchers, going, being guards.
Yeah.
Of course, they were not to operate any guns or anything, but they were going to go guards to go on watch with another grown up.
Yeah.
So they were going to take place in a natural camp routine.
Right.
Environment. Right. So. Yeah, I think, it was, they were quite, I had to say, also you need to have fun. It's not only dangerous to be here, but I felt afterwards it's really dangerous here on Svalbard, but it's not, just you need to know about these things.
Right, we don't know the risks necessarily. For a lot of people, the Arctic is just sort of a mystery, and so you need to better understand those risks. I mean, just as much as I'm thinking here in the U.S. in the West, if you haven't been around in grizzly bear territory, you should know how to act, and you need to learn about that.
And of course, you can suddenly just walk onto a bear. I mean, it can happen. It's not often, but it can happen. And then, you need to have a plan.
You need to have a plan.
How do you actually do that?
Yeah. Well, this is great. I really appreciate you taking the time to... pretty much give us an idea of what it would take to be safe, I think, in Svalbard.
Yeah.
And the steps that we can take to better educate ourselves to be safe there. Yeah.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank
inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program, or radio essay expedition, that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
Tonight we're welcoming back to the show Patrick Schouty. If you remember back from episode 2, discussed with us his projects in pinhole photography. Over the course of the last few years, I've had many conversations with Patrick, and I found out that he spent time up in Svalbard and worked and was trained to protect visitors and travelers and tourists from the threat of polar bears. And I've invited him on the show tonight to discuss his experience on the ground in Svalbard. Welcome, Patrick, from Salzburg.
Yeah, it's nice to be back, Kevin.
Yeah, so we're excited to have you back on Geographical Imaginations. And I think as we're exploring this unique geography of Svalbard, of the Norwegian Arctic, well above the Arctic Circle, it's interesting, I think, to talk to people who have been there on the ground. So what was your reason for going? Did you have a job, or was it for adventure?
Actually, I wanted to go on a holiday visiting my brother, who stayed there for some years and was working there as a guide. And in the last summer, before he was leaving, he had all his jobs done, and we decided to spend some holiday weeks together.
Uh-huh.
And actually, we prepared for a long hike for about 4 weeks. And yeah, it was, how can you say, some hard work to make the calculation because for the food and water supplies and everything, because as you maybe know, Svalbard is not well equipped with shops and infrastructure around.
Right.
And so if you want to go hiking for a long time, you have to carry everything you need in your backpack.
So you went for a 4 week hike in and around Spitsbergen, which is one of the three islands of Svalbard. It's collectively known as Svalbard. And you were hiking and tenting out? You were sleeping in a tent each night?
We planned to spend 4 weeks on a hike.
Yeah.
With a tent and, really to be out in nature.
Uh-huh.
I flew to Svalbard, to Longyearbyen. And the funny thing is, when I landed, my brother told me, we have to change our plans. We cannot go hiking for 4 weeks. We have a job to do. And so that was more or less all the planning we did before, where we wanted to go, changed at the moment that I set foot on Svalbard.
So his job called, basically said, we need you to act as a guide. And so your plan got shifted there. What was the job? What was the job description, if you will, for what you had to do?
The job description was to be a polar bear guard for some big cruise ships that start their tours in Norway and go up to Svalbard and some other islands on the way, and then go to Greenland. And they are planning to land at every possible space.
Yeah.
And on Svalbard, if you want to be somewhere out of the city limits of Longyearbyen,
yeah,
you need a guard, or you have to carry a gun yourself.
Uh-huh.
To protect yourself or others from the from polar bears.
Yeah.
And such big ships, they don't have their own guards because they make a big cruise, and so they to make a landing on the at Svalbard is only one point of their journey.
Yeah.
And so they are hiring guards from some local suppliers. And yeah, that was the job, to go out or to yeah.
So your brother
Go with a ship to it was Magdalena Fjord. It's I think if I remember right, a little bit north of Longyearbyen.
Yeah.
And one of the few places where big cruise ships could make. Or could land to shuttle their passengers to the shore.
So they're shuttling passengers on Zodiac boats from their ship.
Exactly.
How many passenger ship would you estimate? What would you think? 200 people or bigger?
Maybe 200 or 300. Yeah. Lots of people.
Yeah. And so then people decide whether they want. Not everyone does it, I imagine, but the people that decide to make landfall. Take a Zodiac boat, so you're getting, a dozen people at a time, maybe, landing on the fjord there. And what are you doing? Are you there waiting for them and then going to guide them? Or what's your...
We started our journey as a polar bear guard started on with the first ship.
Yeah.
They picked us up at Longyearbyen. And... so they shuttled us with the first Zodiac to the shore. And so our thing to do was to check the surroundings with a binoculars. So to see also the other side of the fjord, and we had a little hike along the shore, looking behind some hillsides where a polar bear could hide. And so we checked all the area there.
Yeah.
And there were no bears, so we told them that they could land their passengers. And then it's a big procedure because they're not coming only few of the people there. They are bringing all.
Oh, they are.
All so right. You have, yeah. They don't have much time, so they are shuttling. I don't know, maybe 10 to 12 people with one Zodiac.
Yeah.
But they're going there and back and forth.
Yeah.
And so you have about 200, 250, maybe 300 people at the shore. And so as a guard...
Wow, yeah.
Or as guards, we were making out some good observation points where you have a good view of all the area.
Yeah.
So you can... Yeah, somehow warn people if a polar bear is approaching.
Uh-huh.
And,
Did you have, have flares? Or how would you warn that polar bear? Through radio? Like a radio? Or
yeah,
through...
we had radios.
Uh-huh.
And also the crew of the ship, all the shuttling crew and the captain and everyone on the big cruise ship also... were connected to us, and so whatever we told them, where are the limits that people can go around or walk around in that area. So they were also checking, and we were really just for the observation or the watching out for polar bears or because it's it's a really big animal. And so, also a very strong and quick one. So it's a good swimmer. If you see one at the other side of the fjord, it would be wise to evacuate the people from the shore because it's kind of a long way, but as a good swimmer, the polar bear is crossing kind of quickly.
Yeah.
And so you really have to be on
the lookout.
how do you call it, alert? Or
yeah, on alert or on the lookout. Yeah. Yeah. So did you see any?
Yes, sure. so not when we were there with the first ship, but after that we stayed there because we had a schedule of three other ships coming the next day.
Okay.
So we put our tent and, yeah.
So you
stayed there for about... Sorry?
So this ship, they're 200-plus passengers, do the Zodiac back and forth. They leave, but you stay on for a couple more days. And you spent the night in a tent.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, wow. And is that when you saw the polar bear?
We had some other ships coming, and, you know, every morning we had to check the area if there is a bear or not.
Yeah.
And we had a good view out of the fjord, so when the cruise ship was more or less approaching, we saw it really long before they would land.
Okay, yeah.
And so we had time to check the area again. And it was one morning when I was, you know, walking towards a small hill from at the side valley from the fjord. And when I was at the foot of that small hill, some maybe 50 or 60 meters away on the top of the hill, there was a white furball approaching. So I called my brother. He was walking to the other side, so we could check a larger area.
Yeah.
And I was taking the radio, you know, check. Whispering, oh brother, maybe I will go back to the tent now. And yeah, it was kind of interesting. You walk slowly, watching the bear.
Yeah.
And the good thing was that he was really calm and obviously not really hungry. So for sure he was smelling me or us there in the area, and but didn't really move toward me. And so I walked back really slowly. You know, you have a gun, and but if a bear is starting to run, 60 meters is not too far for him.
Right.
And when I, you know, he stood there, and I went back and back, and the further I went, the more safe I felt. And back at the tent, we had the tent put up on another small hill there, the hillside. And so we could had a good overview from there. And he was then walking along the way that I went. So smelling around and everything, but I was staying at the shore. And so we called the ship that we actually now have a bear and that they could not land on that day.
Oh, wow.
And the bear was not leaving, and so we had some, a signal gun?
Yeah, okay, a flare gun, ship.
A flare gun, yeah. And we used one of these to scare him away.
And he went away.
To make a loud noise, and he went behind the hill where we were meeting, actually, before. And, he stayed back there. And, but it's a strange feeling if you know you will stay in the tent and the bear is somewhere around.
Right.
So and also the... Huh, sorry?
So you, after spotting the bear... And then calling off the ship on this your second day, did you then spent another night in the tent because another ship was coming the next day? Is that how this worked?
Yeah, it was. Maybe it was not the next day, but they were coming
soon. Yeah,
we had an estimated schedule, but it was like maybe next or in the next day.
Okay.
So we were on. Yeah, we were waiting for them anyway. So, but we had to stay there.
Yeah.
And it was a strange feeling, you know, to know that the bear is somewhere around and you have to stay. But also you have very good protection equipment with you.
Yeah.
So you're not sleeping in the tent alone, maybe in a 4 meter distance around the tent, you put a dripping wire.
Okay.
That is connected to also do some flare ammunition or
yeah flare gun that goes off or yeah.
Yeah. And so if you sleep in the tent and, you know, wake up of a noise, you know that something is happening outside, some maybe 4 or maybe 5 meters from your entrance.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a, yeah, it gives you some time to, you know, take your gun and run out of the tent and see what's happening there.
Did that happen?
No.
That's good.
Not in our case.
But you know of people that's happened too.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But also my brother were hiking some maybe 1 year before that with another friend.
Yeah.
And it was a reindeer who ran into the wire.
Yeah.
So you never know what you will see outside. It could be a bear, could be a reindeer.
Right,
could
right.
Could be some other, maybe wind that is blowing the wire that hard or whatever.
Right. Wow. What did you do with the food? Because hiking in, you know, not polar bear country, but other bear country, black bears or grizzly bears out west here in the U.S., people, you have to do things with your food, whether that's hang it in a tree, in a bag, or sometimes it's put into big metal safe boxes if you're at a popular camping site. What did you do with your food in the Arctic, which I'm picturing the landscape where you are, and at least in my mind, I'm picturing no trees to hang a bag from. And the ground is and the ground is too frozen to dig a hole and to bury the food.
Maybe it's not a big problem that you have your food with you because you are much more interesting as food for the bear than the pasta you bring.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's smelling the people and the food and, yeah. So and whatever is living there or moving there is potential food for a polar bear.
Yeah.
So there are no enemies for a polar bear.
Right. They're the king of the Arctic, basically.
And so on Svalbard, they're really well protected.
Yeah.
What makes perfect sense. And I think was it 2 or 3 weeks ago, or maybe 1 month, when they shot one.
Right, right.
And it was a big discussion in the media and on the internet about the protection of the bears and the tourism. If it's okay to bring that much people to the protected nature.
Yeah.
And yeah. Because as a polar bear guard, in the worst case, you have to shoot the bear if he's attacking.
Yeah. So
you don't want to, but you know, if you have to make the decision between getting eaten by a bear or survive, I would take the second option.
Right. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org.
Now let's get back to our episode.
And so you were provided with a rifle to shoot.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Did you do a little training with that rifle before you went out?
Yeah, the first thing we did when I landed in Longyearbyen was driving to the shooting stand.
Yeah.
And for a real bear gun is kind of a heavy gun. It's a really big one.
Yeah.
Because if you imagine a bear attacking, you're not supposed to shoot the bear long distance.
Right.
So he must really attack you or the group you're working with. And so you don't have that much time. So you need a big ammunition, right?
Yeah.
Big caliber.
Uh-huh.
So if you're lucky and you hit the bear, at least that he will stop. Maybe you're not shooting him dead at the first with the first shot.
Yeah.
But yeah, the first shot should stop him. And so you need a big gun for that.
Right. Did you?
And I never shot with something like that before. And so it was kind of interesting, the first training at the shooting stand.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, maybe you have to get used to the heavy gun. And yeah, maybe you try for the first shot, you just lay down on the floor, you're very stable, you can balance the gun. And so it was okay, my shoulder hurt, but yeah,
oh, wow.
I could manage to hit the target. But then it was like, yeah, maybe not a realistic setting, you know, you will not lay down before the bear and, you know, balancing out everything and trying, you know, to really take your time to focus on the target.
Right.
And then, yeah, you try to shoot in a more or less standing position, very shaky. And it's making things really hard that you can control your shooting in a good way.
Because
and also a running bear is a moving target. It's kind of hard, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different scenario. The adrenaline pumping through your veins and the fears of a bear maybe attacking you, and it's running, and you're just trying to get a shot off, even if only to scare the sound, scare it away, or to injure it with the first shot.
Yeah, the best way is to try to scare him if he's long way away from you.
Yeah.
You can use a flare gun or your gun or whatever, just make a really loud noise, and normally you can scare the bear with noise.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're really in the situation that the bear is attacking, you will not try to scare him. Maybe you can do that if you're more than one guard, you know. One can try to shoot in the air.
Yeah.
But yeah, at that moment, you should really focus on killing the bear before he's reaching you.
Yeah. What did it help having your brother there? I mean, in terms of when you spotted that bear, at least being able to call someone and say, "Look, this is the situation." If you were by yourself, that would be a different story, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of comforting me, so that someone is around. Also, if the bear would have been attacking, he would be way too far away. My brother would have been too far away to really help me in that situation.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I saw the bear was not moving, and so, you know, I knew that my brother was also walking back towards me.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you know that. The closer we got to one another, it was like, yeah, feeling safer and safer with every step.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is maybe also if you get eaten by the bear, at least someone knows what happens. I don't know.
Yeah. Someone to report what happened, I guess. Yeah.
So we've reached the end of episode 54 here on Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I want to thank Ann-Kristin Austad and Patrick Schaudy for sharing their experiences, their work, some of their thoughts, their ideas with us here on the show. As always, I want to thank Mike Allen for use of his song, Sand Dune, here that you hear beneath my voice. I do want to recognize the fact we called this episode Don't Feed the Bears, not at all making any reference that the Arctic is a zoo, taking seriously, most seriously, the safety concerns, risk management, and planning any sort of expedition, whether that is to the Arctic or to any place that you are going around the globe. It's serious concern. It's takes a lot of thinking and planning and using best practices when we go out and do physical expeditions, not just radio ones from the chair here at home. Polar bears are a real threat in the Arctic, but as you heard from our guests tonight, there may be even more serious threats, anything from avalanche to bacteria to the elements, the cold elements, and surviving out there in those polar conditions. We are continuing this series on the Arctic. I am going to the Arctic in 3 days, to Svalbard, for the very first time. So stay tuned for episodes more about Svalbard, more about the Arctic. Stay tuned. Thanks. Bye.